and welcome to COVIDcast, a Lowy Institute podcast for anyone interested in understanding the global effects of the coronavirus pandemic. My name is Lydia Khalil, and I'm a research fellow at the Lowy Institute in Sydney, Australia. As this crisis unfolds, we're sitting down with experts from a range of fields to discuss the implications of coronavirus for the world. In this episode, we turn to the United States and the Trump administration. In a statement posted on the White House website titled "President Trump's Historic Coronavirus Response," Donald Trump is quoted as saying that my administration will stop at nothing to save lives and shield the vulnerable. Yet from the start and over the course of this pandemic, President Trump has continually downplayed the threat of the virus, ignored previous pandemic planning, demanded immediate reopening, and did not heed and in fact interfered with expert medical and policy planning advice. As it stands, 7,840,400 people in the United States have been infected with the coronavirus, and at least 214,900 U.S. citizens have died. The virus has torn through every state of the Union. According to the latest available statistics on the Johns Hopkins University Coronavirus Resource Center, the United States is the country with the most recorded cases and the most recorded deaths in the world. The virus has even seeped into the White House, with the president himself becoming affected earlier this month in what was dubbed a super spreader event celebrating the Supreme Court nomination of Judge Amy Barrett. Trump's positive COVID diagnosis and uncertainties around the president's health has caused further upheaval at an already precarious moment in the U.S. with political polarization high, domestic political violence increasing, racial protests ongoing, all on the eve of an upcoming presidential election next month in November. To talk through the Trump administration's COVID response, I'm joined by Olivia Troy, the former Homeland Security Advisor for Vice President Mike Pence and former member of the White House COVID Task Force. Olivia began her career in national security after the September 11th attacks. She served in the Pentagon as a George Bush administration appointee. Olivia Troy was an intelligence official in the Department of Homeland Security, where she served as Chief of Strategy, Policy, and Plans under the Obama administration. She recently resigned from the White House in August of this year, citing President Trump's mishandling of the pandemic. She's not the first official to resign, but has recently appeared on a video sponsored by Republican Voters Against Trump, where she is the first administration official who worked on the pandemic response to speak out publicly against the president. Olivia, welcome and thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Lydia. Thank you for having me.
Let me start by first asking you how you came to work for the Trump administration. Was it a political appointment or did you become involved in another way?
No, actually, quite frankly, although I'm a lifelong Republican and started my career in Republican politics and was a political appointee under President Bush, I actually joined the career service and have remained as a career intelligence officer the entire time. And I was assigned from the Department of Homeland Security to the Vice President's office, what we call, you know, the U.S. government a detailee. And I was not in a political slot. I was there serving as a career official, and I was chosen by actually Secretary Nielsen's office based on my background and the skill set. And they thought that I was the right fit to serve best in the role.
So even though you were detailed to work in the administration, did you have any reservations in joining the Trump administration? And if you did, how did you talk yourself through those to work for an administration that was already very controversial?
Well, you know, during President Trump's campaign, I had heard some of his rhetoric, and I am a Mexican-American daughter of a first-generation Mexican immigrant. And some of that rhetoric was offensive to me during his campaigning days. And I had hoped that that rhetoric would subside once he took office. I thought it was maybe perhaps a campaign thing used to, you know, mobilize his base or whoever the audience was that he was appealing to. So when I came to the crossroads of deciding, when I was offered the role and asked if I would be interested in the job, you know, I had to really, I thought about it and I said, well, this is an opportunity to try and make a difference and an opportunity to serve. And I also point out that I served on the vice president's staff on his national security team. I had considered possibly working on the National Security Council, but my role was very different and our staff ran very differently than the NSC.
So like you mentioned, before COVID hit and before you joined the COVID task force, you worked as the Homeland Security Advisor for the vice president, where you covered many things related to Homeland Security. So terrorism and extremism, as well as border security and immigration, all things that the president has made many controversial statements about and enacted much criticized policies to address. And here I'm thinking of the president calling white supremacists and white ring extremists who attended the 2017 Charlottesville rally, for example, very fine people, withdrawing U.S. troops from northern Syria, that potentially jeopardizing the Islamic State task force, the separations of families and the detention of children at the border. All of these Homeland Security policies and positions taken by President Trump have been strongly criticized as short-sighted and, in fact, have exacerbated the threat of terrorism and extremism in the United States. What did you make of those policies while you were working in the administration? Did you agree with some of those policies? Did the vice president, or did it all come from the president and his inner circle?
I'll speak frankly and say most of these policies were driven, in fact, all of these policies were driven by the president and his inner circle. And that inner circle has a lot of power. It's a very powerful force. And I found a lot of these policies, quite frankly, to be disgraceful, abhorrent, especially when it came to the child separation issues and some of the things that you saw play out in America. Those were very challenging issues where I sat in these interagency U.S. government meetings where we discussed, you know, how we were going to counter or figure out how to implement these issues or execute some of these, especially executive orders that were coming out, that quite frankly, a lot of them were very controversial. And from my perspective, were not given much thought as to the long-term national security implications of a lot of them. And coming from the world that I come from, that is the lens that we in the national security community and the intelligence community look at it from. And it was hard. And I think for the group of us that hung in there and the colleagues that I have a lot of respect for who were career people for the most part and who were trying to figure out the best way to manage the chaos that was happening around us, the chaos that is the Trump administration and some of the advisors, you know, in his main circle of influence, the chaos that they sort of impose upon us was hard. I think at the end of the day, we felt that it was better for us to be there and have a seat at the table to try to steer this in the best way we could when, to be frank, we had the losing hand, right? We were oftentimes seen as the deep state, as you've heard this administration refer to career service people who really actually have backgrounds in some of these issues, who have the career knowledge and the experience to try to figure out the best way to do some of these things without causing great damage. Yet at times these opinions were overshadowed or they didn't want to hear them because they felt that they were just these never Trump people trying to derail the president's agenda, which was quite frankly not true. I saw my colleagues, I saw how hard they worked firsthand.
Let's turn to the emergence of the virus. When did you first hear about it? Talk us through the beginning days of your experience of what would become the COVID pandemic and how the COVID task force in the White House was established.
So early on, it was January timeframe, we were aware of a situation developing in Wuhan. You know, there were intelligence briefings on it. There was an interagency group convened at the staffer level and at the policy coordinating committee level for the National Security Council, just to kind of understand what was happening. It was clear that the situation as it went on in Wuhan was getting more and more serious from what we could tell. And we were looking at it from a very external perspective. And early on, I think there were a lot of unknowns about the virus, what we were seeing, and we didn't have access into Wuhan in China. You know, we weren't allowed to come in. We had requested access very early on. CDC and, you know, our Department of Health and Human Services was advocating and trying to gain access on the ground so that they could go in and study the virus firsthand and help the WHO and help China with the situation that we saw developing. And we weren't granted access for weeks. This went on for a while. And we knew that something serious was happening. And as we saw it spread, you know, we wondered about the rate of spread. And these are all the questions that are happening amongst senior level people in the interagency. And that's when you see cabinet level officials start to convene. And these meetings are convened. And this is when you see sort of the beginnings of the task force get announced by the White House towards the end of January. And this is prior to the vice president becoming the lead on it. You know, he gets tagged to lead it later in like February timeframe.
So the task force is established, but at least what we've been perceiving from the outside is that that task force's work has been undermined from the beginning and throughout its tenure by the president. There have been numerous studies recently, including by Cornell, Harvard, the Atlantic Councils, that have actually demonstrated that President Trump is the single largest transmitter of misinformation surrounding COVID-19, that he's actually a super spreader of COVID-19 disinformation. What are some examples of this COVID disinformation that was spread by the president against the task force's work and advice and planning?
I think from very early on, he was very concerned with playing down the pandemic. He didn't want people to know the severity of what this currently was at the moment and what it would become. And I think it was challenging to sit there and work so hard. So much work was put in by task force members and experts, right? We had access to the greatest minds and experts in this field, the perfect combination of people to respond or at least advise on a pandemic of this magnitude were there. They had the seats at the table. But unfortunately, you had the president come out and he would say things like, this isn't as bad as it seems, this is going away. You know, there's the number of cases is decreasing, when in reality, the conversations having being held in the task force are that cases are continuing to increase. We're concerned about hotspots. We're concerned about our medical facilities getting overwhelmed. We're tracking all of this. And we're concerned about having personal protective equipment available for our healthcare workers. And we're concerned about what happens when it spreads to communities in a greater way. And we're concerned about people having access to therapeutics, I mean, testing, a myriad of issues. But then you have the president going out in public saying, you know, it's a Democratic hoax, I believe, is how he refers to it. This is something that they've come up with. And from day one, he politicizes the virus, which is very detrimental during a pandemic crisis of this magnitude, because you've now fundamentally divided the country on a very critical issue, where you're going to put lives at risk. This is not something that should be taken lightly. These are lives. These are human lives, and people are going to die.
Did you have any sense of why the president downplayed the threat of the virus? Do you feel like it was because he sought to use it as an opportunity to divide and conquer, as his political style is? It seemed strange to me, because usually leaders thrive in a crisis. It's an opportunity for them to show strength. So I was curious if you had any sense of understanding of why he downplayed it.
Well, I will say that the president was very focused on the economy. He always has been, and his track record on jobs. And that is one thing that he has touted. That is one of his successes, right? And here you have a situation where there are a lot of unknowns, but you do know that likely it's going to impact everything. It's going to impact everything across the board, whether it be businesses, the economy, jobs, schools, families. This is something that's going to touch everything. And there's really nothing you can do about it. And I remember him watching his advisors and him being very concerned when they saw the stock market drop, when a CDC expert gave a very stark briefing in February. And you can see the stock market drop, and the reaction inside the White House was very much one of, okay, that's it. We've got to control the messaging. And that's when you see a complete switch, and you see the VP brought in, and he is tapped to lead the task force because the White House decides we can't have this happen again. And it's very unfortunate. That is where the mindset is. Because if you think about it, if you're the president of the United States and you actually are looking at it from the economic aspects and the impacts, then what you want to do is you want to encourage people to wear masks. You want to encourage people to slow the spread of the virus as much as possible, because it will impact the ability of businesses and states and, you know, towns to reopen. It's very short-sighted.
So speaking of this, you know, the president, as you mentioned, has flouted mask wearing and social distancing guidelines. We spoke about how the president was a super spreader of disinformation, but the president himself contracted the virus, likely, and potentially spread it to others within the administration during an event at the White House recently, Judge Amy Barrett's nomination to the Supreme Court. And I'm curious to know, were there any WorkSafe protocols at the White House? Did you feel safe from the virus working at the White House?
There were certainly protocols put in place. There were signs saying, encouraging the hand washing. You know, Matt Pottinger, I will say to his credit, the Deputy National Security Advisor, from early on walked around wearing a mask and said, we should all be wearing masks now. And we should be going on shift work. We should not be sitting on top of each other, especially in the West Wing. And you do see some people on the National Security Council, which is in the Eisenhower Executive Office Building, wear masks, and you see them slim down staffing. But the West Wing is a completely different situation, which is, you know, not ideal, because that's where the president and the vice president sit. And the West Wing is a very small space. There's not a lot of room to social distance. And wearing a mask, if you're sitting right next to each other, because there's no room to separate, is critical to protecting each other and protecting our country's leaders. But it was very rare to see someone in the West Wing wearing a mask. Usually it was someone coming in for a meeting, or it was the doctors on the task force, or Dr. Birx, who had an office in the West Wing. She wore her mask all the time. And then we would go to the meetings and we would take our masks off. And, you know, the White House will say, well, people were being tested on a daily basis. Well, not everyone was. If you were going to see the vice president or the president, I believe, you know, they had you tested. I was tested daily because I saw the vice president daily. But there were numerous staff that did not get tested who were walking in and out of the West Wing all the time. And as we know, the test isn't necessarily completely accurate either. There are false negatives. There are false positives. So what we were saying publicly as a task force and what was going on behind closed doors in the White House were two totally different things. And I was surprised that it took that long for the president to fall ill. I was always certainly concerned about protecting the vice president. And I remember washing my hands all the time. And I remember being very cognizant of the fact that any one of us could give it to each other. And when you're working in the White House with our country's leaders, that has grave consequences.
So for you, what was the straw that broke the camel's back for you? Was there a moment you could remember where you said, this is it, I'm no longer effective or able to work inside this administration? Or was it a cumulative effect?
I think it was both. It was a cumulative effect of consistently watching a lot of things happen behind the scenes where the scientists and the doctors and the public health agencies were being discredited, and their work was being manipulated in a way that I knew was dangerous to Americans. CDC was trying to do their job, and political influences were consistently at odds with them and overshadowing it. You see guidelines changed along the way. You see school guidelines changed. You see, you recently probably saw in the New York Times covered an article where the political officials in the White House overruled the mandatory mask coverings or face coverings for transportation workers. I mean, that is just appalling that that would even be a need for debate. This is protecting critical infrastructure and transportation workers. So it was a combination of all of these things that I have seen in an aggravated manner along the way. But it was also, you get to a point where you feel like you're fighting the good fight every single day. But as the election got closer, I will say that the dynamics got harder. And I knew that at some point, it's really hard to overcome that dynamic and those voices. And I did not want to be complicit in participating in some of these things. And I was certainly not going to lie or betray the vice president, me personally, in my role in that way.
Now, two people you worked very closely with and within the administration, the vice president himself and Lieutenant General Keith Kellogg, have dismissed your criticisms. They've said that you were fired and your criticisms are coming from a disgruntled employee playing politics. You've denied this. You know, you've been around politics throughout your career. It can be a brutal business. It's not uncommon for those within an administration to protect the president against those criticizing him and undermining those who speak out publicly. But does this protection of the president by senior officials who are rumored to privately criticize the president himself feel different to you? What do you think that says about those around the president and their priorities?
Well, I think that what you'll see is a culture of fear is real, which is why you see a lot of people still who will criticize a president or be concerned about things that are happening behind closed doors, but they won't go public because they are concerned of what happens when you do. And there's a certain kind of vindictiveness that happens here. And watching, you know, in my case, the vice president and especially General Kellogg, who I worked for very closely and with, and he knows that I did my job very dedicatedly. But at the end of the day, it is about the president and protecting him. And you watch people do things that are quite frankly unbelievable at whatever cost, because at the end of the day, they're concerned about pleasing him and doing what he asked them to do. And I'm confident that they were told you have to take care of this because she was on your staff. And, you know, I know the truth. I know how I resigned and I know that I was asked to stay. And I'm disappointed, especially on the extent that General Kellogg went to describe my departure. But I'm also not shocked by it.
So that was within the administration, but the president seems to have a rusted on base of supporters outside within the U.S. populace. And they've weathered through with him through different scandals and different mismanagement. Do you think that this time is different, though? Is Trump's base responding any differently to the mismanagement of the pandemic response? Or do you think that they're going to stick with him no matter what?
I think the president has a certain base of supporters that are unwavering, and that group will never change their mind. They are all in. You know, they believe in the fake news mantra that he says about them. They don't waver on it. But I certainly think that given everything that's happened in the past few months and how personal this is for people, right? COVID is real. It doesn't matter if you're the president of the United States. It doesn't matter who you are. This virus doesn't discriminate. Everyone is vulnerable to it. And I think that watching the president disrespect all of those people who have lost people and who have watched people suffer from COVID the way he did by going out on the balcony and taking off the mask and, you know, the reporting or rumors that he was planning to come out and take his shirt off and show off a Superman t-shirt and show how strong he was. I don't know how any American can sit there and continue to support him in that way. And I think we will see a change of heart and sort of the plain reality that this is our country's leader and this is quite frankly not okay.
So you've also said that you would be skeptical of any vaccine that was launched before the election. Why is that?
You know, the president's been known to lie repeatedly and to do things solely for the purpose of his reelection and solely for selfish reasons as well. That he, you know, he focuses on things because he really truly only cares about him. You know, if President Donald Trump came out and said, we have a vaccine and he's the only one saying, you know, we have it, we're going to distribute it, go take it, that would give me serious pause. Now, if Dr. Fauci comes forward and the scientists come forward and say, we finally have a vaccine, we've been working on this hard throughout this entire year, we know that it's safe, we can guarantee that it's safe, that's a very different conversation. And I would be, you know, I would feel much better about it and okay with it. And that's something I think that everyone needs to watch for.
So Olivia, I'll end with this question. It's a two-parter. The polls show that President Trump is trailing by double digits, though we've seen from the last election that polls can be wrong, but still it's a significant number that can't be ignored. Do you think that other Republican leaders outside of the administration are beginning to distance themselves from the president because of the pandemic? Or do you think they'll continue to support him for their own political prospects and for other Republican priorities, like the Supreme Court nominee, for example? And related to the presidential election, you've been a lifelong Republican. You said you would vote for Joe Biden this time around. I guess my final question is, if Biden wins the next election, what do you think the impact of the 4 years of President Trump already has been on America? What has the impact been internally and on U.S.'s standing in the world?
Well, I think 4 years of President Trump has been detrimental to how we're viewed globally. I think that, you know, he has embarrassed us. I think, you know, we have been a superpower and we have been a great ally to many countries, you know, Australia included and the UK. But quite frankly, it's been embarrassing to watch him pander with some foreign adversaries that we know don't have the best interests at hand, such as Russia and others. And I think in terms of domestic politics, you know, the Republicans have a serious question to ask themselves as a party. I think he has changed what the Republican Party has been and what it is today. I think there is a difference between being a Republican and a Trump Republican. I am certainly not a Trump Republican, and I know many who are not. I know many Republicans who are very upset about what is happening and the direction of our country in terms especially of the party. And as far as the people who are currently in GOP Republican leadership right now, you know, I think they are equally as appalled. You'll see them make statements at times of how upset they are, or they'll talk about the pandemic and the changes that need to happen. Ted Cruz, Senator Ted Cruz, recently said, we may have a terrible election. You know, it may be horrible for the Republicans, but they are scared. They're also scared because when President Trump turns on them and doesn't support their candidacy, we've seen them lose and we've seen the detrimental effects that it has. And so I'm not quite, I'm frankly surprised that any of these people continue to stand by him, because I think that they feel that they need him. I think that says a lot about the base right now of where the Republican Party is. If these people fear that sort of standing so much, I think that tells you where the future of the party is going, and it's going to make a lot of Republicans like me question where that leaves us after Joe Biden, should he win, right? And I am supporting Joe Biden because I think that he will do what's best for our country at a time where things are very challenging for us. And he will at least behave in a presidential way. And he will understand how divided we are. He will take the pandemic seriously just by the fact that, you know, he will tell Americans to wear a mask and he will not spread misinformation that is hurtful to our recovery.
Olivia Troy, thank you once again for joining me for today's discussion on COVID and the Trump administration.
Thank you, Lydia. I really appreciate you all having me on the show.
COVIDcast is a limited edition podcast from the Lowy Institute. Thank you to my colleague Jennifer Reinhart for production assistance. And please keep an eye out on our social media channels for details on the next episode of COVIDcast. You can stay up to date with all the latest developments on coronavirus via the Lowy Institute's digital magazine, The Interpreter. Thank you all for listening, and stay tuned for our next episode.